Our main speaker tonight is Jeffrey.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey. I'm a grateful recovering addict and alcoholic. Hi. Wow. Well, the psychology books tell you that everybody's greatest fear is public speaking. So if I was going to, if I was going to feel that, this would be a great opportunity. This is an amazing, amazing crowd. There's also a tendency when you're speaking to so many people to try to make your story entertaining. And if my story sounds entertaining at all, I want to try to convey the pain and the loneliness that were behind what seems like entertaining. I heard a lot when I first came in that people would say, I came for my drinking and stayed for my thinking. So let me give you a little bit of an idea of what my thinking was like when I was given the grace in 1996. I was in the process of searching for a jeweled walking stick like Salvador Dali carried because I thought that that would be appropriate for me. I was developing a new handshake because regular handshaking was very boring. So I was working on something that was kind of like a thrust. I don't know, I'm not sure who I expected to do that with me, but I took it very seriously. And I had stopped saying hello when people called me on the phone. I would just say, speak to me. Because everyone said hello, and it was very boring to me. Everything was very boring to me. And my children would call me, and they'd be like, Dad, you sound like a moron. Why are you saying, speak to me? And I didn't really have much of an answer. You know, when I came in, my hair was almost to my waist. It's not short now, but it was literally almost to my waist. I wore leather clothes, I had red glasses, and I was not in the music business. No one in my field ever looked like that, and there was no reason for me to accept that it was a big FU to the rest of the world. Because I always hated stereotypes. I hated when you could look at someone and tell what they did for a living. It was very boring to me. Very, very boring. Everything was so boring to me. The first car I ever bought myself was what you would refer to as a pimpmobile. It was the first time I had any money. I had accomplished things in my life. I was one of those functioning alcoholics, and I was able to accomplish things. And so I went out to buy a car, and I grew up in the Bronx, so I went to this place in the Bronx, and I bought a car that had been made for one of the Isley brothers. And it was a Mandarin Orange Eldorado. I got confirmation on that many years later when I actually met one of the Isley brothers who remembered the car, and I had sent him a picture of it, and he confirmed it for me. But it was made for one of the Isley brothers, and I went out and I bought a Rolls Royce grill because that's what the pimps drove. And I had met a pimp from Maryland, and his name was Benny. And I was very impressed by his lifestyle. And he drove a gold Eldorado with a clear bubble over the driver's seat and a clear bubble over the passenger seat. And that's who I aspired to be. And he happened to be black, and that was around the same time that I got tired of my ethnicity. And so I played Superfly tapes in the car, and I carried two guns. One was a Walther PPKS, because that's what James Bond carried. And I carried a 25 Beretta on my ankle. And that wasn't enough. I carried an extra clip in my pocket. I don't know who I thought I was going to shoot, but I was always ready. I carried guns to synagogue. I carried guns on the beach. And you can only imagine how hard it is to hide a gun on the beach when you're wearing a bathing suit. But I managed to do that. So needless to say, my thinking was very strange. And I'm very fond of saying that we go crazy one day at a time. You know, we get sober one day at a time, but we also go crazy one day at a time. If you went to bed sane one night and you woke up insane, there's a good chance that you'd notice. But when it happens over 20 years or more, you get used to it. You get used to your thinking, and your thinking makes sense to you. And because so many of us are gifted with intelligence and creativity, and all, we tend to believe our thoughts. And one of the great things that I learned when I came in here is that your thoughts may not be true. You know? Just because you created it, we create all our own thoughts. That doesn't necessarily make them true. The same as feelings are not facts. Now, when I came in, I was a very sensitive child. I grew up in the Bronx in a very middle-class family, and my sensitivity overwhelmed me throughout my whole life. And I talk about this a lot, and I think it's important, because in the rooms I've met so many creative and sensitive people. And for me, my sensitivity always felt like a burden instead of a strength. As a child, if I even thought that one of my grandmothers lived alone, it would bring tears to my eyes. I grew up with that burden, and I felt everyone's feelings. There was a time in my life, if I was with you and you were sad, I was sadder for you than you were. I overfelt my feelings. I was an antenna for feelings, which made me have to back away. And it made it look like I didn't care, when the truth was that I cared too much. You know, my sobriety has allowed me to own my sensitivity as a strength and not as a weakness, to the point where, you know, I lost both of my parents in my sobriety, and I was able to be there for both of them because people in the rooms had the courage to share that they were able to go through that. And one of the things about spirituality that we learn is that it brings us all together because we're all really the same. You know, when people tell their story, we identify because there's only so many things that a human being can do and can experience, you know. The names change in the story, but the feelings that we express are the same. And so, you know, I had to learn to own this, what I felt was a burden to me. And again, I mention that because it's important that we honor that in ourselves. The more spiritual you become, the more sensitive you become, and the more empathetic you become. But you learn to use it in your life so that you can be helpful to other people. And that's one of the greatest lessons that I learned. As I said, my insanity told me to leave my family. It told me many things. I was always fascinated by how close sanity was to insanity. And growing up, I tried to experiment with that. I would do unusual things, you know. I have photographs of me laying down on the New York State Thruway. Now, if you're going to do that, you have to be very quick, because other cars don't expect it. They don't expect someone to be laying on the thruway. But I needed to know what that felt like, and I had a friend take pictures of me. I would drive in the mountains and turn the lights out in my car so it would be pitch black so I could experience what that was like. I had magical thinking. I used to think that I could actually touch the third rail, and how could I get hurt if I went like that? Because what could be faster than that, you know? And I believed it. It made sense to me. It all made sense to me. And, you know, and I could argue with you on any point, you know, because, again, if you've ever been able to accomplish anything in your life, you tend to think that you have some kind of power. Powerlessness is a very hard concept to grasp, which is why they say that the first step is the only one that you have to do perfectly. You know, part of my story that I always tell is, as I was growing up, I was a very severe stutterer until I was in my 20s. I stuttered so badly that I couldn't say my name, and it was a nightmare for me. My parents took me to speech therapy, and no one was able to help me. And I was determined not to go through the rest of my life as a stutterer. When I applied for college, I made myself run for the president of my class. Now, I looked at stuttering. I must have had some feeling that I didn't really fit in, and that I wasn't liked by people, even though that's not what people told me. The message they gave me was that I was included and I was liked, but for some reason I grew up with very negative thoughts about myself. And so I made myself run for the president of this big college, and I couldn't even say my name. I had other students introduce me and say, "This is Jeffrey, and he's running for president, and we'd like you to vote for him." And once I got started, I could speak. And one day I realized, what happened was that I won the election. But I told myself, if I win this election, I won't have to stutter anymore, because it'll show me that people like me. Because you can't win an election if no one votes for you. So I won the election. I was the president of the freshman class, and I still stuttered. And it was a great lesson for me. It taught me that outside validation doesn't work. It doesn't matter how many people tell you that you're wonderful and talented and fabulous. It really matters what you think of yourself. And so I made up my mind that I wasn't going to go through the rest of my life as a stutterer. And I was given the grace to figure out how not to stutter. I worked on myself for a few years. And I basically took my mind apart. And I did almost like a fifth step on myself. Like I told myself, I tried to build up my self-esteem. What I did was I took basically what must have been an inferiority complex and turned it into a superiority complex, not to feel better than other people, but just to feel even. It's like if you take a piece of paper and you fold it, in order to get the crease out, you have to fold it the opposite way exactly so that the paper will be flat again. That's how I looked at it. And I was given the grace to figure it out, and now I no longer stutter, which is an amazing thing for me. The reason I tell that story is because when I tried to get sober, I thought to myself, if I can stop stuttering, I can stop drinking anytime I want to. Because I controlled my mind enough that I could stop stuttering. It's very hard to stop stuttering, especially when you're a severe stutterer. And I learned that great lesson again, that I'm powerless over alcohol. I was not powerless over stuttering. And it's part of the serenity prayer. We say, you know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the most important line, the wisdom to know the difference. If I wasn't given the grace to have that wisdom, I'd still be stuttering today. Because there is a thing as acceptance. You have to accept certain things about ourselves. There are certain things that we cannot change. But stuttering was one of those things that I was able to change. Alcoholism, I was not able to change. Only through the grace of God and through my spiritual connection was I able to give that up. So my insanity told me to leave my family, which I did, and I moved to Manhattan, and I led, you know, and it was the hardest thing for me to do, by the way, because I had a wonderful wife, and I had two beautiful daughters that were my heart. They mean everything to me. They still do today. And it was the hardest thing I ever had to do. But the alcohol and other substances ruled me. And let me just say that I never liked the taste of alcohol, so I drank it straight out of the bottle. I kept Absolut in the freezer, and I mixed it with anything that said, do not swallow with alcohol. And I would immediately swallow it with alcohol. And I'll leave it at that, because this is AA. But I just to mention that. So I moved to Manhattan, and I led a very crazy life. And again, when I say I led a crazy life, you know what that is, because there's only so many things a person can do. And so we all did the same thing, and it was very bizarre. And in 1995, I got a phone call that my ex-wife was putting my youngest daughter in a rehab. And it was one of the most painful phone calls that I ever got. Now, I never told my children to get high, but children try and emulate their parents. It's just natural. And the lifestyle that I was espousing by the lifestyle that I was leading led my youngest daughter to really act out in a terrible way. And not only was she drinking, but she was doing heavy drugs to the point where her boyfriend died in her arms of a heroin overdose. And she went into a rehab, and the same day that my best friend passed away. When I grew up in the Bronx, it was very rare to have Jewish heroin addicts. And he kind of like invented it, I think. I don't know. He was a heroin addict for a long time, wound up with stomach cancer, was on methadone for like 20 years, and died of stomach cancer as a very young man. And his funeral was the day that my daughter went into rehab. And I had a terrible choice to make. But of course, I went to see my daughter. And when I got there, they wouldn't let me see her because they said that she misbehaved and she wasn't allowed visitors. And I was not sober and I went crazy. And I said, I missed my best friend's funeral to come and see my daughter, and you're going to let me see her. And they did let me see her. And she begged me to take her out of there. She said, Dad, if you love me, you'll take me home. And somehow I got the strength not to take her home. And she's a sober young woman today. She spent 28 days there and she's got a family and everything is wonderful. Everything is great. And I tried to get sober that year in 1995, but I tried to get sober out of guilt. And it was another lesson that I learned, that you can't get sober for anybody but yourself. You can't get sober because people beg you, because people who love you care and they try to get you sober. You have to get sober when it's in your heart to get sober. And I went to one meeting a week. I would go to the Mustard Seed. I'd come back from a crazy weekend in the Hamptons and on Sunday night, and I go to the 6:15 meeting at the Mustard Seed, which is a wonderful meeting. But I looked at it as if it was a party, because everything to me was a party. It was a social event, and I thought I would meet people, and I'd meet some girl who would probably take my mind off the girl I was trying to forget. Always a different girl, but, you know. No one spoke to me at those meetings. And I was probably because I was putting out a vibe that said, don't talk to me, you know? Because people are very sensitive to that energy of what we put out, you know? And we don't realize that. Animals do that very easily. But we do the same thing. We feel each other's energy. So that was a terrible year for me, 1995. I lived basically in a blackout. And I didn't know it was possible to basically live in a blackout. But when I got sober, I challenged myself to go to some very trendy place that I thought I had never been to before. Because that was my life, you know, towards the end, you know, like I had told myself I didn't know how to be a good father. But when my daughters grew up and they got older, I could hook them up on the New York nightlife scene. And that would be a great thing for me. I could show them what a good dad I would be. So when my little girl was 11 years old, I snuck her into a club. And that's how she wound up with the problems that she had. And so, again, so my thinking was so twisted. So, you know, I lost my train of thought, which is not a good thing to do. But let me see. Oh, yes, thank you so much, yeah. I went to a place, so I was very into trying to go to the next trendy place. And it was pretty early in my sobriety, and I said to myself, I'm going to give myself the confidence to go to this place, and if they don't let me in, they don't let me in. I'm sober now. It's not going to mean anything to me, you know? I didn't even really know where it was. I went to a place that I did know, and there was a and I heard that this place was nearby. And I walked in the street, and I saw some people walking, and I started to follow them, and I go come up to a place, and it's got velvet ropes. And I come up, and there's no sign, and the doormen all greet me by name. And I don't know where I am, and they bring me inside, and I have no idea where I am, and I see somebody, and I said to them, this is going to sound really weird, but where are we? And he tells me the name of the place, and it's the place that I was trying to go to. And so I said, that's amazing. And I see another guy I know. I said, listen, this is going to sound weird, but do you see me here? Have I ever been here before? He goes, do you see me here a lot? He goes, yeah, you're here all the time. So I had been frequenting a place that I never knew that I was there. That was my 1995. So the July 4th weekend of 1995, I was suicidal. I had partied really hard that weekend, and that Monday, I sat on my bed, and I took one of my licensed guns, and I put it in my mouth, and I was wondering whether I'd have the courage to pull the trigger, because that's how sad I was. And I thought of my children, and obviously I didn't do it, but it took another 10 months for me to come in, because that's how much pain we take. I don't know how we do it as alcoholics. We live with so much pain. 10 more months until I was given the grace. When I came in this time, I came in for myself. I wanted it with all my heart. And I'll tell you one of my great God stories. On my second day of sobriety, I was at the 79th Street workshop. And it was a 12:30 meeting. And at 1:30, I wanted to go to the 2 o'clock meeting, which was a men's meeting. And I had a project with me that I was reading. And it was such a beautiful summer day. And I thought to myself, maybe I could go to Central Park and just sit on a bench and just relax, you know. And I walked to Central Park, and I found a secluded spot, and I sat down on a bench by myself, and I'm reading this thing, just trying to calm down. You know how crazy you feel on your second day. And a man came by with a dog, and he sat down on that same bench, and he kept trying to strike up a conversation with me. And I don't go to the park to meet men. That's not my thing. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it wasn't my thing. And this guy wouldn't take no for an answer. He kept trying to strike up a conversation. And I remember thinking in my mind that I wanted to say to him, you know, I don't want to be rude, but I just don't want to talk to anybody. But thank God I didn't say that, because that guy had 7 years in the program, and he was supposed to meet a sponsee on that very bench. And the sponsee had always been reliable. That day he didn't show up, and that man became my sponsor. Talk about a God story. And he was in the same field that I was in. And I had this big envelope with me. And he took that envelope and he wrote down the 7 days of the week. And he wrote down every meeting that he wanted me to go to. And I carried that big envelope with me for 6 months. Because if you write something for me on a big envelope, I don't know how to copy it to a smaller piece of paper. That is completely beyond my skill set. I would rather carry that big envelope. And I did that, and I carried it everywhere, and I still have it. I came across it recently, and it was amazing. But that was my God story. Talk about not wanting to meet man. I would have skipped through the park holding his hand. I was so happy to meet this guy. And he stayed my sponsor for the first 10 months, and he took me through the steps right away, because that's how he did it. And I took him to every ridiculous party that I went to. And he said to me, if his sponsor ever knew where I took him, he would kill him. But we bookended it. We stayed sober, and he taught me about that, that you go someplace with someone who's sober. And if your spiritual connection is strong enough, you can go anywhere. And I learned a lot of great lessons, because this is a program of great wisdom. When you first come in, it feels like it's a program of just not drinking and doing other substances. But it's really a program of leading your life according to certain principles. And they're ancient spiritual principles. They're very powerful. And when you incorporate them into your life, magic starts to happen. You can't help it. And you don't have to try to do step 12. It happens automatically. You automatically bring it into all your affairs because you become a different person. Your thinking changes. You know, I have so many gifts in my life. I have such a long gratitude list. When holidays come around, I'm a guest at my ex-wife's house with her and her husband. She remarried and she adopted two other children and had one of her own. That couldn't have happened had I stayed. You know, you learn to look at your life in retrospect. And those children needed to be adopted, and that little girl needed to be born. And so I needed to do what I had to do in the years when I left my family in order for that to happen. Now, you can't see that at the time that you're going through it. You're too close to it. It just feels like a lot of bad things are happening in your life. But as you become more sober, you learn that that was your path and that there are no accidents and that you can't only believe in these principles when it's convenient for you. You either believe or you don't believe, you know? And I choose to believe, you know? I used to wonder why, when I was active, if I go into a church or a temple and I would hear people praying, it would bring tears to my eyes. I never understood it. It was because I needed that. I needed that spiritual connection. I heard sayings like, show me an alcoholic, and I'll show you a man in search of God. And that was meaningful to me, because I was always on a quest for knowledge and truth. I grew up never understanding the insanity in the world, why people all didn't get along, you know, why there was hatred in the world. I never got it. And that made me drink, because my feelings were too uncomfortable. So I've learned so much, you know. This is a very special night for me, not only to speak at the Atlanta Group, which is a great honor, and to speak for AA, but today, I was told, happens to be AA's 79th birthday, which is amazing, which is... Thank God for Bill and Bob, you know. And on June 22nd, I'll be celebrating 18 years through the grace of God. And thank you. And I took June 22nd as my sobriety date because that's my oldest daughter's birthday, because she was the one who had the courage to confront me. You know, in 1996, the first 10 days, I had taken my youngest daughter to live with me because her mother had asked her to leave the house because she was doing heroin, and she said, I can't have a heroin addict in the house with babies. And I said, don't tell her till I get there. I'm coming right now, because I hadn't been a full-time father for so many years and I was living with that guilt. And I took her to live with me, and for the first 10 days I wasn't sober, and she would go to bed around midnight and she'd say, Dad, it's okay if you go out because I know you really want to. When I go to sleep, it's okay. And I was so sick that I did that. And after 10 days, my oldest daughter got the courage to confront me, and she called me up and she was screaming at me. And she said, what kind of a father are you to be out all night? My friends see you in the clubs, and you know, what's the matter with you? Your daughter is so sick. And I couldn't answer. I was just sobbing. And that's when I came in with all my heart. You know, I just wanted to be sober more than anything else. And I drove my youngest daughter to school every day, and I helped her graduate from school. And all these magical things started happening when I was given this gift of sobriety. How am I doing on time? What do I have? 5 minutes? You know, I carry three things with me every day. I carry my 17-year coin, and I go to a meeting where they give out coins, and I'll be very proud to get my 18-year coin. But I carry my 90-day coin with me. I've been carrying it all this time for 17 and a half years because it's so hard to get 90 days of sobriety. And everybody out there who's sober, even for a day, it's such a miracle. When you remember the day when you couldn't leave your house without having a drink or other substance inside of you, and suddenly you never have to do it again, that is unbelievable. That is unbelievable. I was given the grace that my obsession was lifted when I came in 1996. I didn't have to fight it. And I went to every kind of place imaginable where I would have been tempted and I wasn't, because I didn't know enough to stay away from those places. I didn't know how to lead my life without going to events. So I went all these places, and it was a testament to the power of the program that I was never tempted to pick up. There were people that offered me things, drink tickets, all kinds of things, and I never really had the temptation to pick up in almost 18 years. So honor your time. You know, when I hear people counting days and they're not really sure of their days, my first sponsor taught me, be very proud of those days. Honor those days. Make sure you know the date of your sobriety. And the other thing that I carry with me is the promises. And I have a little tradition when I speak. I always read the promises, because if you do the work, the promises come true. So I'm going to just finish on that. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. For people out there who are just starting this journey, it's the best gift that you could ever give yourself. If you think your life is going to be boring, you're really wrong. Because I live by the motto, if it's not fun, I don't want to be there. And sobriety is a lot of fun. You meet wonderful people. Whenever I travel, I wear this little emblem that my first sponsor gave me, the AA symbol. You can't see it because I'm wearing a tie tonight, because it's the Atlantic Group. But I always wear an open shirt with my symbol proudly showing, and I've met some amazing people. And in the beginning, people would come over to me and they'd say, oh, are you a friend of Bill's? And I'd be all excited and be like, yeah, you too? And they'd be like, no. And so I don't do that anymore. When people, I tell them it's an ancient spiritual symbol, which is partly true. It's a triangle of body, mind, and spirit, and a circle of harmony. And if they say to me they have a necklace like that, I ask them, how many years do you have your necklace? And then I tell them I have my necklace almost 18 years, and that's how I share my sobriety. Anyway, I want to thank Todd for asking me to speak, and I want to thank all of you for my sobriety. Thank you very much.